visitors, we're always glad to have you, and we want to do what we can to make you feel welcome. And we also want to remind you that our purpose here is to study God's Word and to worship Him as He has instructed us. And if we can impart some knowledge to you, if we can encourage you somehow to be faithful to God, then we've accomplished our purpose. We want to, again, welcome everybody that's here. Now, the passage that we have for a text, as we have up on the screen, is Matthew 24. We're going to study that. And the reason we're going to study it is because Stan Cox said that we're supposed to. Well, you know, Monday night he talked about what is called the AD 70 doctrine. And the AD 70 doctrine consists of just really there's one thought that you need to understand about it, and when you do that, and everything springs from that, and when you understand it, you go, huh? But people are serious, and churches have divided. Now, I've preached this lesson before, but from a different perspective, from a whole different perspective. And that was the perspective of battling Jehovah's Witness and premillennial notions about the coming of the kingdom, which are false, that are not taught in the Scriptures. Well, somebody has taken a backwards look at everything in the Bible, and they've gone to the other extreme, and they have decided that every prophecy in the Bible, including the resurrection and judgment and second coming prophecies, were fulfilled in AD 70 at the destruction of Jerusalem. That includes the resurrection prophecy. And I have asked the proponents of this, the ones that I have been able to reach, what happens to us when we die? And I haven't gotten an answer yet. I'm not talking about an answer that could be understood. I'm talking about any kind of an answer because they charge on to something else. And one of the teachings is that with the destruction of Jerusalem, you have the culmination of all of God's purposes and plans. And they talk about this church age as being the eternal kingdom that God promised, like we're in heaven now. Now, I want to know something. If we're in heaven now, then why did I have to have my gallbladder out a few years ago? That certainly was not a heavenly experience, and neither was a kidney stone. And I've had a few flat tires, and so have you. That just doesn't fit the picture at all, but they teach that this is the culmination. This is what all of the Bible is looking forward to, not so much the home in heaven. Do they believe in a home in heaven? I understand that they do, but the reason I do is not because they say so, because I just can't imagine anybody wasting their time if you're just going to die, and that's it. And it's appointed unto man wants to die, and we're going to die. Even from this life, even though now, I know that there are a lot of people that think Sedona is heaven on earth, but forget it. After a while, you get sick of looking at red. But, because I've lived there. But it is a beautiful place, but it's not heaven. So we want to begin by reading Matthew 24, verses 1 through 3 again, and see what Jesus is talking about. Kind of, this puts things in perspective. And it nails down the subject at least as far as the first part of Matthew 24 is concerned. One of the problems that they have with Matthew 24 is they want to make Matthew 24 and 25 all the same day. And of course, Matthew 25 talks about the day of judgment. And so the destruction of Jerusalem in their minds is the day and the only day of judgment. Well, it says here, and Jesus went out from the temple and was going on his way, and his disciples came to him to show him the temples of the buildings of the temple. But he answered and said unto them, see ye not all these things? Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down. Not one stone left upon another that shall not be thrown down. That is the destruction of the temple. And that kind of helps us understand that the premillennialist is not correct, because Jesus is talking about the day when the temple would be destroyed. Well, the AD 70 people said, well, that's right, David. That's when the temple is being destroyed. That's AD 70. And then everything they apply to AD 70. Well, let's look, because a lot of it does apply. A lot of confusion and false teaching in a lot of different areas. But now, we need to be careful when we're studying this passage. It says in Matthew 24, verses 4 and 5, Jesus answered and said unto them, take heed that no man lead you astray. For many shall come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and shall lead many astray. Now that's true with reference to premillennialism. It's also true with the AD 70 doctrine. You say, well, how do people believe this? How do people get drawn into it? They have overactive imaginations is all I can think of, and it separates them and in some way in their minds exalts them above their brethren. They know something that nobody else knows. And so they're susceptible to being led astray by those who teach error. Well, we want to look at the context, first of all, and see what Jesus is talking about. The last part of Matthew chapter 23, he pronounces woes upon the scribes, Pharisees, and hypocrites, as he does all the way through Matthew 23. And he says that they're every bit as bad as their fathers who persecuted the prophets that came before. And down toward the end, he says in verse 35, that upon you may come all the righteous blood shed on the earth. Upon you shall come all the righteous blood shed on the earth, from the blood of Abel, the righteous, unto the blood of Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, whom ye slew between the sanctuary and the altar. Verily I say unto you, all these things shall come upon this generation. The generation that Jesus was speaking to is going to pay the price, not only for their own sins, but for the sins of the fathers who persecuted the prophets as well, but just didn't do as good a job as they did. And so he says, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, that killeth the prophets and stoneth them that are sent unto her, how often will I have gathered thy children together, even as a hen gathereth her chickens under her wings, and ye would not. Behold, your house is left unto you desolate. For I say unto you, ye shall not see me henceforth, till ye shall say, blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord. Blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord. That would be Jesus. You'll not see me until then. So here's kind of a setting in which he makes this statement. Jesus talks about their house being left unto them desolate. And so as soon as they get to where they can see the house, that is the temple, the apostles show them the building. Are you talking about this? Well, look at this beautiful, wonderful building. What do you mean it's going to be torn down? What do you mean it's going to be left unto us desolate? Many years ago, myself and Johnny Revis and Craig Ritter and Gary Johnson, we climbed Mount Whitney. And when we went to look over the trailhead, we met some women who had been all the way over in Kings Canyon and been on a six-day hike across, and they were coming out there. And it was 2 days after 9/11, the destruction of the Twin Towers. Now, these women were from New York City, and when we told them that the Twin Towers had been crashed into by airplanes and that they'd fallen to the ground, there was nothing there but a hole in the ground, they called us liars. Jesus said, there's going to be a time when not one stone is left standing on a stone. And the apostles didn't believe him either. Just could not conceive of it. And so their response was not exactly what Jesus would like, but it was what Jesus expected. Now, there's the quote of Jesus. Now, here's their response. It says in verse 3, and as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, tell us, when shall these things be, and what shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the world? Now, you'll notice I have up there a three-part question. It is a three-part question, grammatically. And so we look at it and see what they're asking. First of all, tell us, when shall these things be? What things? When the temple is destroyed, the house is left desolate, and not one stone is left on another. When shall these things be? Pretty obvious. When is the destruction of this great city? Now, they equated the destruction of the Jewish order with the end of the world, because, you see, they thought the Messiah would come, and within the scope of what they had then, he would reestablish the kingdom of Solomon and David under the old law. Now, that's what they thought. So the only thing that could happen when the destruction of Jerusalem occurred would be the end of the world. Now, I know some of the more modern translations, and the original Greek, have in it, what's the sign of the end of the age? But their intent, they were talking about the end of the world. Because the end of this age, the end of the messianic age, they'd already accepted Jesus as being the Messiah, to them would be the destruction of the world. That's it. That's the end of it. But they also asked this question, what shall be the sign of thy coming, your presence, and what shall be the end of the world? What shall be the signs of the end of the world? These things were all weighing heavy on their mind, and so Jesus makes an answer or an effort to answer them in their questions. Again, here are the questions that we have lined up. The sign of thy coming is the one that we want to focus on for just a minute. We have this answer of Jesus, which constitutes, first of all, a warning about the false prophets that we read a while ago. Jesus answered and said unto them, take heed that no man lead you astray, for many shall come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and shall lead many astray. There are a lot of theories. There are a lot of notions. There are a lot of ideas. Just listen to what Jesus says, and you'll be okay. When you start listening to what the premillennialists say, or Max King and his ilk say, then they're going to lead you astray because they're men and they have ideas contrary to what the Scriptures teach. Now, then he answers the questions. First of all, there are going to be false signs. And you'd be surprised how many people who believe in premillennialism take these signs to be signs of the coming when Jesus says they're false signs. Look at verse 6. And ye shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that ye be not troubled, for these things must needs come to pass, but the end is not yet. How do we know we're in the end of time? Well, look at all the wars going on all over the country, all over the world. Well, what did Jesus say? He says the end is not yet. This is not the end. This is not a sign of the last days. Now, he gives some signs, as we noted already in verse 5. There's the warning about the false prophets. And then there is the wars and rumors of war. In verse 6, ye shall hear of wars and rumors of war. See that be not troubled, for these things must needs come to pass, but the end is not yet. In other words, these wars and rumors of wars have got to happen first. Famines and earthquakes, verse 7. For nation shall rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be famines and earthquakes in different places. And there have been ever since Jesus uttered these words. Okay? Then what's going to happen? Verses 8 and 9, it says, but all these things are the beginning of travail. Well, what does that mean? Is there a period of time that has the label travail on it? Or is this just the condition of their lives? I think it's the condition of their lives. Suddenly, he's just saying suddenly things are going to turn worse and you're not going to enjoy what you're enjoying now. Then shall they deliver you up into tribulation and shall kill you, and ye shall be hated of all nations for my namesake. He's talking there about the persecution that is going to arise. All of this is before the end. These are false signs. These are signs that people look at today and say, oh, it must be the end times. But even for the destruction of Jerusalem, Jesus says the end is not yet. False signs. And then the apostasy. Apostasies existed during the days of Paul, during the early ministry of Paul. Before, in fact, some existed before Paul was converted. But it says, and then shall many stumble and shall deliver up one another and shall hate one another. And many false prophets shall arise and shall lead many astray. And because the iniquity shall be multiplied, the love of many shall wax cold. So we have all of these signs that Jesus says, but the end is not yet. It's false signs. The end is not yet. Well, what's the point? The point is verse 13. But he that endureth to the end, the same shall be saved. You need to be faithful, whether Jesus is coming in judgment today or tomorrow or the next day or not. You need to be ready. You need to be faithful. And the apostles especially needed this because they would be the special subject of persecution throughout their lifetime. Now, there are signs given for the end. Now, the end that we're looking for is the end that he was talking about, when one stone would not be left standing on another stone, the destruction of Jerusalem. This is what he's talking, this is the subject, this is what they asked about. When shall these things be? And this is the answer to that question. Okay, first of all, verses 14 and 15, he says, "And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in the whole world for a testimony unto all the nations, and then shall come the end." Then shall the end come. Then, when the gospel has been preached through the whole world. I had some fellows standing at my door, as they were wont to do on Saturday mornings, and tell me that the end did not, that this is not, there's not talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. Well, why not? Because the gospel hadn't been preached in all the world yet. Well, let's see in just a minute. Let's look at the other sign. He says in verse 15, that when therefore you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken through the, Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, let him that readeth understand. Let them that are in Judea flee to the mountains. When you see the abomination of desolation, spoken by Daniel. Now, let's look first of all at the gospel being preached everywhere. The sign, the first sign of this end that he's talking about. Look first of all at Colossians chapter 1 and verse 6. This is in the mid to early 60s AD when Paul was in prison. And he says in Colossians 1 and verse 6 about the gospel, which has come unto you even as it is in all the world, bearing fruit and increasing. And then a little bit later in verse 23 in the same chapter, it says, if so be that you continue in the faith, grounded and steadfast, not moved away from the hope of the gospel which you heard, which was preached in all creation under heaven, whereof I, Paul, was made a minister. Those who claim that this could not be fulfilled yet because the gospel hadn't been preached to anybody, they don't know the book of Colossians. They don't know it. Because it says it had been preached in all the world. May not have been, not every person has heard it yet. Maybe. But it had been preached in all the known world at that time, and that's whatever all the creation under heaven means in Colossians, it means the same thing in Matthew 24, and whatever it means in Matthew 24, the same language is used in Colossians. So there's the first sign. Now, I'm not going to read Daniel 11:31 and Daniel 12 verse 11, except to say here's the reference to the abomination of desolation. We have a New Testament passage that helps us to understand it. When Luke is writing the account, what Jesus says, instead of the abomination of desolation, he says, but when ye see Jerusalem compassed with armies, then know that her desolation is at hand. When you see Jerusalem compassed with armies. Well, when was that? Well, when the Romans laid siege to Jerusalem. Well, what did that immediately precede? It preceded the destruction of Jerusalem. So what is he talking about up until this point? He's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. There's not a bit of doubt in the mind of one who's an honest Bible student. That's what he's talking about. That's exactly what he's talking about. But now, he says something a little bit later in Matthew 24 and verse 34. He says, verily I say unto you, this generation shall not pass away till all these things be accomplished. So whatever was going to happen up until this point, was going to happen during a generation's time. And he didn't say a generation's time. He said this generation. Well, which generation are we talking about? Well, this one. Well, I know what this podium means. I know what this Bible means. Why would I not understand what this generation is? It means the one that is present. Unless designated by the speaker as to be a particular generation of another time. And then they say, well, here's our generation, and here's this generation of Moses. But it has to be designated to be understood that way. We'll look at that a little bit further later. Verily I say unto you, this generation shall not pass away till all these things be accomplished. That is all that he's talked about up until that point. Now, instruction for the time. Look at verse 16. Matthew 24 and verse 16. Let them that are in Judea flee unto the mountains. Well, what if you're not in Judea? What if you're in Mesa, Arizona? Well, then you'd be digging canals with a stick because you'd be a hole cam. There weren't any of these people in Mesa, Arizona at this time. They were in Jerusalem. Who's he talking to? He's talking about people who would be alarmed at the destruction, the impending destruction of Jerusalem. Now, they're supposed to leave behind material things. Verse 17, let him that is on the housetop not go down to take out the things that are in his house. And let him that is in the field not return back to take his cloak. So, don't worry about those things. Just get out of town. Run. Run for your lives. Woe unto those who have small ones, he says in verse 19, but woe unto them that are with child and to them that give suck in those days. Now, at the second coming of Jesus, what's going to be the problem? Jesus will take care of all of that, and nobody's going to hide from whatever destruction. Jesus will take care of those who need to be taken care of, and he'll destroy the rest. So what's the point of fleeing? There isn't any. Okay? But with the destruction of Jerusalem, there is a need to get out of town. And those who have faith or trust Jesus' word, they're going to do it. Pray for good conditions, he says in verse 20, and pray that your flight be not in the winter, neither on a Sabbath. Well, why? Because you won't be prepared to go. What difference is that going to make at the second coming? It's not going to make any difference because you're not going anywhere. You're not leaving unless Jesus takes you. Well, they were headed into a time of great stress. Look at verse 21 where he says, for then shall be great tribulation, such as hath not been from the beginning of the world until now, nor ever shall be. In other words, it's the worst time for them that they could possibly be. And except those days had been shortened, no flesh would have been saved. But for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened. Well, the trouble with the premillennial view is that the elect are all going to be raptured during that period. So what? What's the big deal? They claim that it's shortened to 7 years of tribulation. Well, if you're good, you're going to be missing in action. So it doesn't make any difference. So why would he shorten the days for the elect's sake? They're not going to be here. Well, they have to say something to make it all fit, I guess. But the point is, once again, you need good conditions because it's going to be miserable for a little while, but it'll be over pretty quick in the general scope of things. Now, something else that he says, look at verse 26. And I've got verses 23 through 26, but look at verse 23. Then if any man shall say unto you, lo, here is the Christ, or here, believe it not. For there shall arise false Christs and false prophets, and shall show great signs and wonders so as to lead astray, if possible, even the elect. So always, as long as there's going to be people on this planet, there are going to be false prophets. You get that idea? Behold, I have told you beforehand. If therefore they shall say unto you, behold, he is in the wilderness, go not forth. Behold, he is in the inner chambers, believe it not. Well, you have these people on television saying, well, look what all's happening in the Middle East. And they'll pick out some particular event. And they'll say, see, that's a fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy. What did Jesus say? He said, don't believe them. Well, before the destruction of Jerusalem, there are a lot of people who began to say, well, Christ is here, Christ is there. A lot of people claim to be the Messiah. He says, don't believe them. They knew who the Messiah was. And they knew what the Messiah was going to do after he finished talking. Now, he goes on to say in verse 27, for as the lightning cometh forth from the east and is seen from even unto the west, so shall be the coming of the Son of Man. Everybody's going to see the coming of the Son of Man. Now, he's not talking about the second coming here. He's still talking about the same thing. He's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. And when people saw the destruction of Jerusalem, especially those people who were aware of the prophecy, they were amazed. And they knew who did it because he said 40 years before that he was going to. And he says, wheresoever the carcass is, there will the eagles be gathered together. Now, the word eagles there literally is vultures. Some people think that the eagle is a noble bird. Well, I've got some of the best pictures I've ever taken of a bald eagle as he was struggling with the crows to see how much dead deer he could get down. He was just one of the crows and acted like them. Except when the crows flew off and I stopped my car to take the picture, he just flew up on top of a juniper tree and gave me the eye like, I'm bigger than you, but he wasn't bigger than my car. I could roll up my window. It's a vulture. And when you see the vulture circle around, you know there's a dead body. Well, what's a dead body? It's the city of Jerusalem. Well, there are other things to note about this time. For instance, it is a judgment. This time is a judgment against the wicked. And this judgment is couched in symbolic language that we need to take note of. Now, it immediately follows this stressful time. He says, but immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun shall be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven, the powers of the heavens shall be shaken. Somebody says, well, that didn't happen before the destruction of Jerusalem. No, it didn't, did it? He goes on to say, and then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in the heavens, and then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And they say, well, isn't that talking about the second coming? No, it isn't. The context is going to determine what is being spoken of here, and that's not what he's talking about. We'll see in just a minute. And he shall send forth his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they shall gather together from his elect, from the four winds and from one end of heaven to the other. Now, sometimes we have a struggle determining exactly what is being spoken of here, and I've got to tell you, with reference to exactly what is being spoken of, some of it is mysterious to me, but the language is not. The language is familiar to me as I have been a student of the prophets since college days and before, a little bit before. And you see that this language is used in other places, and no one would say that it's talking about the second coming. For instance, Isaiah 13 and verse 10. It says, for the stars of heaven and the constellations shall not give their light. The sun shall be darkened in its going forth, and the moon shall not cause its light to shine. It's not exactly the same, but it's the same kind of language. Well, what's he talking about there? Well, he must be talking about the second coming. No, he's talking about the destruction of Babylon, the desolation of Babylon. If you'll read Isaiah 13, you'll see that quite clearly. And then in Isaiah chapter 24 and verse 23, it says, then shall the moon be confounded and the sun ashamed, for Jehovah of hosts will reign in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem, and before his elders shall be glory. The glory of God is going to block out the moon and the sun, the light from them. Joel 2 and verse 10, the earth quaketh before them. The heavens tremble, the sun and the moon are darkened, and the stars withdraw their shining. He compares the invading hordes that are sent to Israel in judgment to a cloud of locusts that cause the night to become day. Joel 2 and verse 31, the sun shall be turned into darkness, the moon into blood before the great and terrible day of Jehovah cometh. Joel 3:15, the sun and the moon are darkened, and the suns withdraw their shining. These are all judgments against ancient peoples. Now, I want you to notice a passage in the book of Acts that helps us to place those passages in Joel where everything's turning to darkness. In Acts chapter 2, beginning in verse 16, referring to the time when the apostles begin to speak in tongues, he says, but this is that which has been spoken through the prophet Joel, and it shall be in the last day, saith God, I will pour forth of my spirit upon all flesh, and your sons and your daughters shall prophesy, and your young men shall see visions, and your old men shall dream dreams. Yea, and on my servants and on my handmaids in those days will I pour forth of my spirit, and they shall prophesy, and I will show wonders in the heaven above and signs in the earth beneath, blood and fire and vapor and smoke, and the sun shall be turned to darkness and the moon into blood before the day of the Lord come, that great and notable day. What's he talking about there? He's talking about a first century establishment of the church and the events that surround it. And one of the things that comes about eventually is the destruction of Jerusalem, the judgment of God against that city in that great day. So this is what he has to talk about there. Now, with reference to the Son of Man's coming on the clouds, Isaiah 19 and verse 1 says, "The burden of Egypt, behold, Jehovah rideth upon a swift cloud and cometh unto Egypt. The idols of Egypt shall tremble in his presence. The heart of Egypt shall melt in the midst of it." Ezekiel 32 and verse 7, "And when I shall extinguish thee, I will cover the heavens and make the stars thereof dark and cover the sun with a cloud, and the moon shall not give its light." It's another judgment against Egypt. And then in Ezekiel 34 and verse 12, "As a shepherd seeketh out his flock in the day that he is among his sheep that are scattered abroad, so will I seek out my sheep, and I will deliver them all out of all the places where they have been scattered in the cloudy and dark day." Again, a judgment against the people that would take Israel captive and would oppress them. Now, you'll notice the last part of the prophecy there in Matthew 24. He says in verse 31, "He shall send forth his angels with a great sound of trumpet, and they shall gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other." Well, when he pronounces judgment against the oppressing nations, he says the same thing, and they were delivered when God returned the Jews to Judah that we've been reading about in Ezra and Nehemiah. Matthew 26 and verse 64. Now notice what he says here about all of this. "Jesus saith unto him," that is unto the high priest, "Thou hast said, nevertheless, I say unto you, henceforth ye shall see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of heaven." Ye shall see it. Who's going to see it? The high priest and those who are there with him. So Jesus coming on the clouds can mean, of course, his second coming. But in these contexts that we've been reading, including Matthew 24, it's talking about his coming in judgment against those who rejected him. And there's really not left a whole lot of question in the scriptures about it. Now, again, the saints' redemption from trial is also suggested. Look at Luke chapter 21 in verses 25 through 28, where we have a parallel passage. Now, Luke is not near as interested in the detail as Matthew is, and the reason I know that is because he doesn't spend very much time on what is included in Matthew 24, but he does include some essential elements. He says in verse 25 of Luke 21, "And there shall be signs in the sun and moon and stars and upon the earth, distress of nations in perplexity for the roaring of the sea and the billows, men fainting for fear and for expectation of things that are coming on the world. The powers in the heavens shall be shaken. And then shall they see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. But when these begin to come to pass, look up and lift up your heads, because your redemption draweth nigh." Now, what in the world is he talking about? Well, of course, he's talking about heaven, somebody says. Not necessarily. In this passage, the redemption that they were looking for is the deliverance that they were to have from persecution, at least for a while. If you look all the way to the book of the end of the book of Acts, you find the last records that are given before the destruction of Jerusalem that we know of, recorded by Luke. And you see some persecution at the hands of the Romans. But let me underline that word some persecution. Where was the death and destruction and the imprisonment, the stonings? Where did that come from? It came at the hands of their brethren, and it was so hard on them that many turned back. What is the book of Hebrews about? People who were discouraged and turned back to Judaism. But when the destruction of Jerusalem came, the Jewish persecution of Christians ended. And for about 20 years, 25 years, the church had a respite. And at the end of those 25 years, then Domitian, understanding that Christians would not worship him as a god, began his persecution of the church. Began it all over again. So what Jesus is talking about here is the respite that they enjoyed from the Jewish persecutions, which would come when one stone would not be left standing on another stone. Now, the affirmation of those signs is seen in Matthew 24 and verses 32 through 34, where it says, "Now, from the fig tree learn her parable. When her branch is now become tender and putteth forth its leaves, ye know that the summer is nigh. Even so also, when ye see all these things, know ye that he is nigh, even at the doors. Verily I say unto you, this generation shall not pass away till all these things be accomplished." And when you see this in the context in which it is given, and you see it in the historical context, you know that this generation is the generation he is speaking to and that they are living in. Now, for some reason, the premillennial position has always been that it's the generation that begins the show, the beginning of some great marker in time. Before World War II, I can't really tell you what it was. I don't remember. But everything was supposed to happen within a generation, and they said, well, a generation is about 40 years, so it's 40 years from some great marker. Well, when the Jews were restored to Palestine by the UN Charter in 1948, all of a sudden they had a fixed point from which to work that generation. A generation of 40 years. And Hal Lindsey, in his book, The Late Great Planet Earth, said that it would all wind up 40 years after the return of the Jews to Palestine in 1948. That would make it 1988. Well, when would it begin? When would the rapture take place and the tribulation begin? That'd have to be 1981. What happened in 1981? Ronald Reagan became president. That was a rather rapturous event, wasn't it, for some people? And for some people, it was tribulation, depending on which side of the political aisle you're on. But I can't think of anything else. Can you? Jimmy Carter appointed Cyrus Vance his Secretary of State. Cyrus, wasn't he supposed to be the one that sent the Jews back to... Well, that's 30 years too late. What happened? I don't know. But he went to the Camp David with Menachem Begin and Anwar Sadat and signed the Camp David Accords and said it was the fulfillment of Isaiah chapter 2. He didn't say it was the fulfillment of Isaiah chapter 2. He quoted Isaiah chapter 2 and said the Camp David Accords was the fulfillment of that. He didn't know about the Arab Spring, did he? A bunch of men who are ignorant of the Bible expounding on the Bible and ruling the nations. Hi vey, as they say. What are you going to do with that? Just go back to the book. Get back to the book. Throw away the premillennial books. Throw away the... Well, wait a minute, AD 70 books. How does this all link to AD 70? Well, let me show you. And just this will just take a minute to explain the connection. In this passage, he says, all these things must occur before this generation passes away. And then he says, heaven and earth shall pass away, but my word shall not pass away. That answers the second question, doesn't it? Or that alludes to the second word, not the first one, but the second one. He says, but of that day and hour knoweth no one, not even the angels of heaven, neither the Son, but the Father only. And then he talks about Noah. He talks about, here's this stuff that I forgot to do. He talks about Noah, and he talks about the people that are at the field sowing, and the people who are at the mill milling, and the women who are grinding at the mill, that is. One is taken, and the point of all of that is not that people are going to be raptured away from their jobs. the point is that when Jesus comes at the destruction of the world, some people are going to be ready and some people are not going to be ready. There are no signs. Well, he says it's like in the days of Noah. What sign do they have in the days of Noah? They had some crazy old man up there building a boat up on a hill and telling everybody God's going to destroy the world with a flood. That's the way they looked at it. What do they have today? They have a bunch of crazy old people saying that Jesus is going to come someday and it's going to be the day of judgment and the world's going to be burned up. Well, those people are crazy. That's the way they look at it. It's the same thing, same situation. They continue to marry and give in marriage and they eat, drink, and are merry, thinking one day is going to be like us. It's going to last forever. But the point is that the point that Jesus is making, because we don't know and because we don't have any warnings of that day, we need to be ready all the time. We need to be constantly ready. The problem with the AD 70 people is they don't make a distinction between the questions or the answers. The day of the destruction of Jerusalem or the day for which there are no signs. They don't make the distinction. And so when Jesus comes and destroys, they know that it's about the destruction of Jerusalem, then they think that the resurrection is going to take place and the judgment described in Matthew 25 is going to occur. And so they say, well, it's all figurative. The premillennialist says it's all literal. AD 70 people says it's all figures of speech. It's all we have. There is no resurrection. The judgment day was just a judgment against the people. My question is this. When it says in Matthew chapter 25 and verse 31, but when the Son of Man shall come in His glory and all the angels with Him, then shall He sit on the throne of His glory, and before Him shall be gathered all the nations. But what they have set up is a judgment against Israel and nobody else. But the judgment of Matthew 25 is not a judgment against Israel by themselves. It's a judgment of all the nations. How is the destruction of Jerusalem a judgment against the Shoshones or the Cheyennes or the Arapaho? It was not. They didn't even feel it. They weren't even aware. That time they're probably eating yak somewhere in Siberia, but they didn't know. How was it a judgment against Rome? It's supposed to be a judgment. The judgment day is all the nations are going to be judged. Was Rome judged? No, Rome was the winner. They came out ahead. They thought it was a great victory. It's just like anything else. We plant an idea and we hammer on it until you get enough people to believe it, and then you got enough money to support whatever you're teaching, and you just run with it. And that's basically what the AD 70 doctrine is all about. And you would be surprised that there are some people that some of you know who are teaching this. The church where my in-laws go in Bowling Green, Kentucky, they had about 350 members, and they just peel off about 80 or 90 of them to this doctrine. And as Stan was able to point out, there are several churches in the Dallas-Fort Worth area who have split over this. And you say, well, how could they split over this? They're ignorant of what the Bible teaches. You need to understand what the Bible teaches. And when you hear this stuff coming up, if you not just... When I say know what the Bible teaches, you've got to know something about where it teaches it to. You're not going to be fooled. You're going to say, hey, this doesn't fit the biblical picture of the resurrection or the judgment day. He says it's a resurrection. They say it's a resurrection, but just for God's people, for the church, the churches. But Jesus says all that are in the tombs are going to hear His voice. Even the bad people. Is it going to be a resurrection? Is the resurrection a good day for them too? What is this? Well, it comes down to the question that we had up there on the screen that disappeared. Are you ready? Are you ready for Jesus to come again? Because He is going to come again. And we need to be ready. Because if we're not, then we will be left behind, but not left behind to wonder what happened to everybody, but left behind to wonder why we didn't make it. And to be concerned about the great flame of fire that we see before us. Well, there may be somebody here who has not been baptized into Christ. You need to understand, this is not just one church against another. This is God against the devil. And God's going to win. And you can be on the winning side if you'll submit your will to His, to be His servant. Remember, baptism is not just an event. It's a beginning of a life in Christ. And you need to be baptized. Acts 2:38. If you have been baptized, but you haven't been living faithful, you need to get ready. Because of the day when you're saying peace and safety, and the day when you think not, it will come upon you as a thief in the night or as travail upon a woman with child, and you will be lost forever. No getting you back after that day. No bringing you back. If we can help you by baptizing you, if we can help you make yourself more ready by study or praying, then let us know by coming to the front while we stand and sing.